about anywhere, you had to have a vaccine or a negative test. But other countries are in worse shape. You know, Frank spoke about Britain. Denmark is being hit hard and has instituted a curfew along with Ireland. Germany's been hit and is tightening restrictions. And the Netherlands, A, just went into full lockdown to save their hospital system, said the prime minister. And I spoke with Dutch journalist Thijs Niemansiedijk about his country's tough lockdown right before Christmas. He said people are blaming the government for letting it get this bad because they were sloppy and erratic. You know, vaccine were high, but they let the masks, the face masks, go completely. Here's what he said.
Face masking, you know, wearing a face mask wasn't obligatory anymore after the end of the summer. Whereas in most European countries, it was still, you know, in public spaces and in shops, it was mandatory. In Holland, it was completely abolished.
Let's go to India now, where the health system was overwhelmed by COVID earlier this year. Lauren, how is India faring with Omicron, and are people still masking there?
Yeah, so in Mumbai, where I live, masks are still required, even outdoors. So if I go for a walk in my neighborhood, I've got to be masked. Otherwise, there are these police on motorbikes that come up and give you a fine. A night curfew starts in India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh, tomorrow. And this is despite cases being near historic lows. We were seeing about 5,000 COVID cases a day. We saw a slight rise today to about 6,600. That's in a country of nearly 1.4 billion people. And only a few hundred of those are confirmed to be Omicron, this new variant. Still, you know, this year, India suffered the biggest and deadliest COVID wave in the world. And it was hugely traumatic, and people don't want to repeat that. There's a hope that people still have antibodies from that. But also, it could be that just Omicron hasn't yet arrived in India. About 60% of Indian adults are fully vaccinated. Now, that's only two shots. There are no boosters in India yet, nor is India vaccinating children or anyone under age 18. So that leaves hundreds of millions of people vulnerable. And as you know, India has some of the most densely populated cities in the world, where Delta spread like wildfire. I don't want to imagine what Omicron will do. Scientists say it's much more contagious.
Eleanor, do countries with strict vaccine rules and high vaccine rates feel that maybe they can escape the worst of Omicron?
You know, not at all. I mean, you know, this is a global pandemic, and we've seen that. There's a feeling that it's bought some time, but no one can escape this, you know, pandemic as it careens around the globe. It's good news that it may not be as deadly, but, you know, just in the last 24 hours, France had 94,000 cases, and that's the highest ever. The French government is meeting on Monday after Christmas to reassess the situation, and the spokesman said nothing is off the table as far as new restrictions. And yesterday, the head of France's scientific council had an ominous warning. He said, you know, life could be severely disrupted in January with a huge mass of Omicron cases, over 100,000 a day, and people could be out sick in real key sectors like, you know, transportation, security, food distribution. He said it could cause real chaos. So honestly, people are just bracing themselves for worse.
Yeah. And Lauren, you mentioned how relatively low COVID and Omicron numbers are in India right now, but, you know, I can't get it out of my head, and I'm sure the rest of the world can't either. India's horrible COVID wave earlier this year, because it's got to still be raw in people's memories. Is the government proposing any new action?
It is, yeah. So Prime Minister Narendra Modi held an emergency summit with the chief ministers, those are like the governors of the states, yesterday. He's ordered states to shore up their oxygen supplies, to ramp up testing. But, you know, Modi's in a bind because he wants to avoid mistakes from earlier this year when his government didn't lock down early enough and was criticized for it. But he also doesn't want to be alarmist. Like, India has had really strict lockdowns, and cases are finally down. Stuff is finally opening up. Tourist visas resumed last month for the first time in 20 months. I personally was invited to 3 weddings happening this week alone, all of which were postponed from earlier in the pandemic. People want to get back to life. Modi himself has been holding election rallies. The country's biggest state, Uttar Pradesh, which is bigger than most countries, population 220 million people, holds state elections early next year. The high court there is urging the prime minister to halt those campaign rallies and maybe even postpone the elections. Modi isn't likely to do that. He spoke at a big rally yesterday, but, you know, this night curfew takes effect tomorrow, and they will be limiting huge gatherings. So I think it's 200 people, more than 200 people can't get together in any one place. We'll see if that holds.
Are you going to any one of those weddings?
No, I'm spending good, Christmas good. With my family.
Just wondering.
I wish I could.
Just wondering. Good, good. You're safe with your family.
Unfortunately.
Frank, with the new year approaching and Omicron still a big threat, how is the British government responding?
Well, just like Lauren was saying, in India, politics are a big issue here. Boris Johnson, the prime minister, he's been holding off on any new restrictions for England. Christmas is tomorrow. He knows that there would have been an uproar if he set in new limits. But we may see new restrictions next week in England, especially on pubs and restaurants. And already other parts of the UK have already announced restrictions. Scotland's going to be shutting down nightclubs for 3 weeks. And in Wales, they'll be limiting the size of groups in pubs, theaters, and restaurants.
Frank, you live in the UK. I mean, how are people reacting to this latest wave of infections?
Well, I mean, particularly in London, which has been the hardest hit, people are not shopping as much, which is rare. I'm actually going to be going out doing a little bit of shopping after this, and I'll be interested to see how many people are out and about. Young people have been particularly hard hit. But one thing, is that people are not as fearful as they have been in past waves. Part of that is that we're not seeing the kind of big numbers in hospitals and certainly some of the big deaths that we saw. The other thing is the vaccination rate. More than half the people here over the age of 12 have had boosters. They're administering 800,000 boosters a day right now, and they're going to continue on Christmas Day.
NPR's Frank Langfitt, Eleanor Beardsley, and Lauren Freyer. My thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Great to talk, eh?
Happy holidays, yeah.
When high-profile politicians were rolling up their sleeves last winter to get vaccinated and trying to convince the public that it was safe, former President Donald Trump was nowhere to be seen. But now, as NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports, in multiple recent appearances, he's been touting the COVID vaccines and even pushing back against misinformation about them.
Biden supporters are more likely to be vaccinated than Trump supporters. And since vaccines became widely available, pro-Trump counties have had a far higher death rate from COVID. It's with this backdrop that over the weekend, the former president, in an onstage conversation with former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, said he'd gotten his booster.
Did you get the booster?
Yes.
I got it too. Okay, so...
Those were faint boos you heard coming from the crowd. Trump had a message for those who oppose vaccines, which he described as a life-saving scientific miracle.
Take credit for it. Take credit for it. It's a great, what we've done is historic. Don't let them take it away. Don't take it away from ourselves. You're playing right into their hands.
This prompted what is about as close as Trump gets to praise from President Biden, speaking Tuesday at the White House.
Maybe one of the few things he and I agree on.
Trump told Fox News he appreciated it, but he didn't stop there. In an interview with conservative activist Candace Owens, he stayed completely on message, rejecting the anti-vaccine talking points she lobbed at him.
So people are questioning how...
Well, no, the vaccine worked, but yeah. Some people aren't taking it. The ones that get very sick and go to the hospital are the ones that don't take the vaccine. But it's still their choice. And if you take the vaccine, you're protected.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that although the administration appreciates Trump's message on getting vaccinated, they haven't reached out to collaborate with the former president, who also continues to push lies about fraud in the 2020 election. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. 19 past 8 now, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio on a Friday and Christmas Eve. And yet to come this hour, we'll have Wisconsin Life for you with a story about an Eau Claire newspaper's determination to preserve the community's faith in Santa Claus.
Celebrate the season with special programs all this month on WPR. Enjoy holiday tunes on Simply Folk. Hear the Eau Claire Master Singers on Wisconsin Classical, and listen Christmas Eve to a concert with the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
So Support for WPR comes from Englewood Grass Farm, committed to the health of the herd, the environment, and customers. Grass-fed beef available for on-farm pickup and shipping throughout Wisconsin. EnglewoodGrassFarm.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
In the weather forecast today, patchy fog and drizzle for the south. Freezing drizzle or snow showers possible for the rest of Wisconsin. Highs from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. On Saturday, Christmas Day, partly sunny, a chance of rain, snow, or freezing drizzle, and highs from the low 20s to mid-30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sattva, offering 7 different types of handcrafted mattresses, including delivery, setup, and old mattress removal. More at SAATVA.com. From Charles Schwab, with a variety of financial planning options, from online tools to meeting with a financial consultant, Schwab works to make it easy to plan for tomorrow, today. More at Schwab.com/plan. And from Total Wine and More, whose top 20 wines of the year list can help find a gift or a holiday menu item. Total Wine and More, in store, online, or on the app. Spirits not available in Virginia or North Carolina.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Sarah McCammon. A week into the new year, the Supreme Court will hear 2 cases that will bear heavily on President Biden's ability to enforce his orders on COVID vaccines in the workplace. To help us understand what the justices will be deciding and what the implications could be, I'm joined by Jessica Levinson. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and host of the Passing Judgment podcast. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So first, I want to break down these 2 cases that are going to be argued before the court. And let's start with the one that challenges federal authority involving OSHA, which, of course, is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. What's being decided in that case?
Whether or not OSHA stepped out of its lane, whether or not it went beyond its congressionally authorized authority here by saying we do need a vaccine mandate or a testing requirement when it comes to employees who work at certain places, at places where there are more than 100 employees. And what the challengers really are arguing is, OSHA, you went too far. Yes, we might be in a pandemic, but you haven't shown that you have to do this through your emergency authority, which indicates that you need a grave risk. And so this is really just about how big or small is OSHA's emergency authority when it comes to implementing this vaccine mandate.
The other case focuses on presidential authority, and in this case, the authority of the Biden administration to deliver a federal mandate on vaccinations in the workplace, particularly among healthcare workers. What is the basis for that one?
A very similar challenge here. So what the Biden administration is saying is, look, we have the authority when it comes to institutions that receive federal funds, like Medicare and Medicaid, then we can basically ask more of them in plain language. We can say, healthcare workers, you need to have a vaccine. We're requiring this vaccine for you because you're getting something from us. You're getting federal funds. The challengers are saying no. And you really need Congress to say you can implement something like this. So it really is a battle of how big is executive authority when it comes to these situations.
Right. And if I'm understanding this right, I mean, these cases seem to sort of ground presidential or federal authority in different places. In one case, workplace safety regulations, and in another, in this idea that the federal government can essentially attach strings to funding it provides for various purposes. I mean, how does the law speak to these kinds of situations? Do you have a sense of which argument might be stronger?
Well, there's already been some disagreement in the lower courts regarding both of these questions. And you're exactly right to point out that it does bring up broadly questions about executive authority. You know, this is obviously a very conservative court. We have some signals that they might be kind of leery of the use of executive power in these situations. For instance, the court weighed in on Biden's eviction moratorium, where they said, you know, you want to do that again, you really need Congress to give you the authorization for that, or you really need Congress to authorize this.
You mentioned the eviction moratorium, and this isn't the first case involving COVID safety measures that the court has heard. What have they said so far in other relevant cases, and what might those decisions signal about this one or about these two cases?
Great question. I think one thing that's really important to remember is that a lot of the other vaccine mandates have come from state and local governments, and that's really different legally. We kind of understand and are more familiar with state and local vaccine mandates. It's, in my mind, very clear that that's permissible under a state's, it's called police powers, meaning that states have power to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their residents. And what we've seen from this court, I think appropriately, is deference to those decisions, where they basically have let these vaccine mandates stand. They haven't taken up challenges to those vaccine mandates. There are some situations where the court weighed in on the emergency docket, where there were challenges to COVID restrictions regarding, for instance, restrictions on the number of people who could go to church or temple or mosques. But when it comes to the vaccine mandates, we have seen, I think, the court appropriately treat mandates that come from states and local governments as really falling within their police powers.
The overarching concern, though, of course, is federal authority, presidential authority, and these decisions will either affirm or constrain that. What is the potential for a wider interpretation? For example, could this end up being a much broader action by the Supreme Court, sort of cloaked as a decision about vaccine mandates, but that could speak to other issues?
It could. And I think in some ways it's fair for us to say, okay, the court is giving us an indication of what it thinks about executive power and how far that power can reach, at least in the area of public health. On the other hand, I do think, although it's so tempting, I do think we need to be careful about reading tea leaves and saying, okay, well, this is what the court thinks about Biden's power. Because obviously, as we've already talked about, the power in this case comes from two different situations, from OSHA, from executive authority when it comes to these healthcare workers who work for institutions that get funding from Medicare and Medicaid. And so in a way, the questions are narrow. And so I think we should be circumspect about drawing too many broad patterns or themes from whatever happens in the court next month.
These arguments are coming at a time when COVID is once again surging. Of course, there's this highly contagious new variant, the Omicron variant. So the president's mandates would have a sense of urgency that would seem to demand immediate action from the court. Do you expect the court will expedite this decision?
It's actually a very accelerated time frame for a challenge like this to come before the court, for them to set briefings and then oral arguments in this short of a time. But it needs to be in this case, obviously because of the pandemic, because of variants, but also because of when the mandates are supposed to kick in. The court has to weigh in one way or another.
Jessica Levinson is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and host of the Passing Judgment podcast. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
I love Paris.
In Paris, a new holiday show pays tribute to an American musical genius, Cole Porter.
A lot of fun. The singers was beautiful, and the dancers too, and the story is amazing.
We visit the City of Light, which so profoundly shaped his songwriting. Cole Porter in Paris, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I love Paris.
Hear All Things Considered starting at 4 on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
This is Morning Edition on WPR, and in news, as Wisconsin hospitals deal with surges of COVID-19 patients, the University of Wisconsin System is offering a second round of tuition credits for nursing and pharmaceutical students. More coming up in our newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Staff shortages tied to new coronavirus infections are prompting Delta and United Airlines to cancel dozens of Christmas Eve flights. Lufthansa says it's canceling at least a dozen transatlantic flights over the holiday weekend. Mendy Hickey is the executive director of nursing at Providence St. Mary Medical Center in Apple Valley, California, where she says they're being overrun by patients with COVID-19.
Once again, we are here in the triage tent in the parking lot at St. Mary Medical Center due to the COVID surge that's going on right now.
Canada is setting records for new coronavirus infections. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
It was another daily record. It took nearly 700 days to reach 10,000 new infections of COVID-19 on Sunday, but it took only 4 days after that to reach 20,000. Nearly all of the new numbers are in Ontario and Quebec, Ontario recording nearly 5,800 and Quebec more than 9,300. Officials say case numbers have climbed rapidly as most Canadians spend more time indoors and gather for the Christmas holidays. Health officials have warned people to forego large gatherings for small bubbles and to cut their in-person social contacts by at least half. And most provinces have reintroduced tougher restrictions and capacity limits. And for many people, booster shots and rapid test kits are at the top of their Christmas wish list. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The next coronavirus treatment may come from sharks. That's according to a new study published this month. Researchers from the University of Wisconsin are collaborating with the Scottish biotech company Elasmogen to develop shark antibody therapies. Elasmogen CEO Carolyn Burrell says shark antibodies are very tiny and they have properties that make them good at fighting coronaviruses.
The shape of them and the diversity of that shape, so they can kind of hook into nooks and crannies, so a bit of a target, a disease molecule that perhaps a classical antibody cannot.
Human trials are still years away, but researchers say shark antibodies could be an effective treatment for many different COVID variants, even those we haven't seen yet. But researchers agree that the best line of defense now is still a COVID-19 vaccine and booster. The University of Wisconsin System is again offering $500 tuition credits to nursing and pharmaceutical students who work in clinical or other healthcare settings. Rich Kramer has more.
As Wisconsin hospitals deal with an ongoing surge of COVID-19 patients, UW System Interim President Tommy Thompson has announced a second round of tuition incentives to get healthcare students working in hospitals, nursing homes, and other facilities while pursuing their degrees. But Thompson says he's also been asking lawmakers for more funding to address nursing program waiting lists at campuses.
And I've told the legislature, and I've said publicly, I've said, why don't we educate more nurses? And the reason we can't is we don't have professors.
1,000 nursing and pharmaceutical students will be eligible for the $500 tuition credit if they work a minimum of 50 hours at a healthcare facility by the end of February. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Democratic State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee announced late Thursday that she's suspending her campaign for lieutenant governor. That's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In a statement, she said she will consider her options, but gave no indication if she was considering a run for mayor of Milwaukee. 7 candidates have lined up for that race so far, including acting mayor Cavalier Johnson. Also Thursday, State Representative Daniel Reimer of Milwaukee terminated his brief run for mayor. In WPR weather, patchy fog and drizzle in the south, freezing drizzle or snow showers possible for the rest of Wisconsin, highs from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. It's 8:34.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide and user reviews to help people find tires that fit their needs and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. From Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. It's a holiday season of going all out and scaling back. Shoppers are spending more than ever, but also many more are saying maybe let's not buy anything this year. NPR's Alina Selyukh is here to lay out all of the weirdness of this holiday season. So, Alina, first, the obvious question, how has the Omicron variant affected holiday shopping?
Well, shopping in person, it's affected it a little bit. A company called Placer AI tracks how often people visit stores, and they noticed the impact of this new variant in the past couple of weeks. The last Saturday before Christmas is usually called Super Saturday because it's the second busiest shopping day for stores normally. And this year, Super Saturday was not that super. Less foot traffic than expected, attributed partly to new fears of COVID. But here's the kicker. Omicron or not, people are still shopping more than they did last year.
All right. Now, you've been talking to shoppers about their holiday spending. What are people buying this year?
In that sense, it's a surprisingly typical year. Last year, everyone seemed to be gifting hand sanitizer and masks and other, you know, sad pandemic necessities. This year, we're back to AirPods and PlayStations and toys like Barbies and Legos. Like last year, air fryers are still sizzling hot. The holiday shopping season is on track to set a new record. The National Retail Federation forecasts shoppers will spend up to $859 billion.
You know, one of the words or phrases that I think of that make really 2021 supply chain disruption, because I think everyone was thinking about it and wondering how it would affect now the holiday shopping season. So how did it go?
Well, shoppers are definitely seeing many more out-of-stock messages this year than they did before. And I spoke with a lot of folks who were so concerned about shipping delays that they got started on their holiday lists much earlier than normal. I talked to Shannon Pitten in Western Colorado, who started shopping first week of November. 3 weeks ago, she ordered a little play sofa for her 5-year-old and 2-year-old.
As soon as you hit purchase, it said, hey, there's supply chain issues. This is expected to be here like February 10th. And I was like, oh, well, that is what it is. I mean, happy Valentine's Day.
She is in good spirits about it because there are a couple of other gifts Santa is bringing her kids on time for Christmas morning.
Oh, my God. So she hits the purchase button and then supply chain issues.
Happy Valentine's Day, kids.
Gotta be kidding me. All right. So if stuff from 3 weeks ago is still not here, I mean, is it safe to say that today is too late, way too late to order holiday gifts?
I mean, you might still be able to walk into a store, but not all gifts have to come from stores. You know, this year there's definitely an explosion of DIY holiday gifts. Folks are knitting scarves, paying into vacation funds, re-gifting books. Samantha Romero and her husband in Eastern Virginia have been quilting and packing festive jars with hot cocoa mix.
It's easy to forget how much handmade gifts can mean. And I think I lost that over the years. And especially with COVID last year, we really didn't do much of anything. And, I started to think back on what made me happy in Christmases past. And I remember making cookies and pies with my mom and handing them out to neighbors and friends. And that seemed to mean more than anything to me.
So her advice is, if you are still not sure what to get someone yet today, make them cookies.
But Alina, how will people know I love them unless I buy them something from a store?
Make them cookies.
All right. NPR's Alina Selyukh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vietnam has sentenced four dissidents to lengthy jail terms for what officials are calling spreading anti-state propaganda. Activists say it's part of an escalating crackdown on dissent. This is in a country that the U.S. is keen to keep on its side in a bid to try to contain China, as Michael Sullivan reports.
Like its neighbor to the north, Vietnam is a one-party communist state. And like China, it tolerates little dissent. But four convictions in 1 week?
Well, the Vietnam government is telling the Vietnam people to sit down and shut up. That they are not going to accept any challenges to their rule. They're not going to accept demands for better governance or an end to corruption or the end to human rights abuses.
That's Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. Human rights lawyer and activist V. Tran has another explanation for the timing of last week's verdicts.
I think it is a message
And the message is just like raising two middle fingers to the rest of the Western countries.
Especially the European Union, she says. She thinks the EU has been a bit naive in its approach to Vietnam, especially in the run-up to the free trade agreement the two signed not long ago. Here's an argument she says she heard frequently while in Brussels.
If we, you know, help them raise the economy to a better place, human rights would come with it, right? They also say that, you know, Vietnam is needed in the geopolitical world because this is the place that we can counter China. So we should be nice to Vietnam a little bit, and they will be nicer to human rights defenders.
In fact, activists say the government's crackdown on dissent is just getting worse.
2021 is and has been a very difficult year for dissidents and journalists, because within 1 year, they prosecuted and tried and convicted three groups of activists.
More than 20 people in total, says activist and journalist Tri Hu Long. Among them, his friend and colleague, the prominent journalist Pham Duan Trang. Her conviction and sentencing last week was covered prominently on state-run media. Here's her friend, the human rights lawyer and journalist V. Tran, reading Pham Duan Trang's defiant final statement to the court.
You may imprison me and bask in celebration for eliminating a long-standing thorn in your eye, but you will never be rid of your ugly, authoritarian, undemocratic, anti-democratic reputation. Because an animal is forever an animal, it can never become human.
The judge sentenced Pham Duan Trang to 9 years in prison, more than the prosecutors had asked for. There was an outpouring of support for her on social media, which Vietnam hasn't been able to keep a lid on the way neighboring China has. And the recent surge of the COVID pandemic in Vietnam has dinged the ruling party's reputation even more. Again, activist and journalist Tri Hu Long.
I see major changes in political attitude among ordinary Vietnamese people. They are now much more critical, and they are more willing to stand up for what is right. And I think this is very bad news for the government.
But rights activists aren't likely to get much help from a West more concerned with China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea.
I don't think the outside powers have any desire to rock the boat in Vietnam at the moment.
Bill Hayton is a Vietnam watcher at Chatham House Think Tank in London.
I think as long as Vietnam keeps its repression within certain limits, it'll be privately admonished, but it's not going to be publicly criticized by the big powers, and they're not going to take any practical measures like sanctions.
Another activist is scheduled to be sentenced next week. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:42 right now. Coming up in 9 minutes, Adventures in Caramelization with Steve Inskeep. If he can make spicy caramel popcorn, you can too. He gets some help from Jack Bishop of the PBS show America's Test Kitchen. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday morning at 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, full-service solar installers, now offering virtual solar webinar sessions to learn about the benefits of solar energy. Information is at allenergysolar.com/webinar.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha County Public Health. An overdose can happen to anyone. Get trained on how to administer Narcan. Call 262-605-6741 or email narcan@kenoshacounty.org.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and here are some of the day's news stories. Officials say a massive fire swept through a crowded river ferry in Bangladesh, leaving at least 37 people dead and 70 injured. Many passengers leapt from the vessel into cold waters to escape the blaze early today. A fire official said it took 15 fire engines 2 hours to control the fire and another 8 to cool down the vessel. Attorneys for an oil and gas company are asking a federal judge to reinstate a drilling lease on federal land considered sacred to Native American tribes in the U.S. and Canada. The energy lease in the Badger 2 Medicine area near the Blackfeet Reservation in northwestern Montana was canceled in 2016. That decision was upheld by a federal appeals court last year. Now the Louisiana company that held the lease is making another run at getting a court to restore its drilling rights. The Badger 2 Medicine is the site of the Blackfeet's creation story. It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Klaviyo, working to help brands deliver personalized email and SMS campaigns that drive revenue and create genuine customer relationships. At klaviyo.com/NPR. From Autism Speaks. Autism Speaks is working to create a world where all people with autism can reach their full potential. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen shares a story about an unsanctioned Santa impersonator.
Just in time for the holidays, author B.J. Hollers brings us a Christmas story about an Eau Claire newspaper's determination to preserve the community's faith in Santa Claus.
On a Christmas morning 118 years ago, the children of Eau Claire ran wide-eyed to their Christmas trees, anxious to see Santa's gifts. For most children, Santa had outdone himself, leaving in his merry wake a smorgasbord of candy and nuts and oranges. And the toys, from the rocking horses festooned with silver bows to the dollies fast asleep in their cribs. Yet the greatest gift was confirmation of Santa's existence, which had recently been called into question by a pair of local boys, John Doves and Eugene Cheney, both of whom had penned letters to the local newspaper claiming that a recent Santa sighting was none other than Frank Skinner of Whipple Street. The accusation sent shockwaves throughout Eau Claire. Or maybe not. I suppose we'll never know. But maybe more so than usual, Santa was on the mind of every child that year, as well as the city's newspaper editor. Who can know the editor's true motive for what happened next? In my preferred version, the editor was trying to counteract the damage wrought by Frank Skinner's unsanctioned Santa impersonation. Whatever the reason, on December 22, 1903, the editor of the Eau Claire Daily Telegram took matters into his own hands, publishing an above-the-fold article titled Santa Talked, Telegram Reporter Sends Word. The first-person account, allegedly written by one William Christmasville, recounts the Eau Claire journalist's journey to the North Pole for a sit-down with Santa. Reaching for his press pass, Christmasville began his journey north, eventually arriving at Santa's private office, where the reporter glanced 200 letters from Eau Claire's children piled high atop the desk. Upon questioning Santa on the quality of those letters, Santa replied that he was quite pleased. In fact, Santa added, Eau Claire children can write better than those of any other city in the world. They must have good teachers. Next, Christmasville pressed Santa on a range of issues. When will you arrive in Eau Claire? Christmas Eve. Yes, but what time? No comment. How will you distinguish the children? Santa paused, considered it, and then, much to the editor's enthusiasm back home, put in a plug for the paper, assuring the Telegram's readers that he was a regular subscriber and had saved the Telegram's art section containing the pictures of pupils in the different schools. Christmasville's interview ended on a somber note, with Santa conceding that not every Eau Claire child would receive a visit from him. Regrettably, seven local youngsters had made his naughty list, their infractions ranging from failing to complete their schoolwork to being cross with their mothers. Always the optimist, Santa refused to give the names of these children, Christmasville reported, because he said they might be better by Christmas. Christmasville's dispatch was published between a story of a train wreck in Kansas City that left 9 people dead and a murderer who was brought to justice in New York. Admittedly, it was a nice change of pace, and Christmas, it seemed, had been saved. But just for good measure, in his Christmas Day edition, the editor offered one last pitch on behalf of the holiday. The editor began by acknowledging that though many locals, whose heads are bigger than their hearts, scoff at the foolish work in preparation for the holidays, there is indeed something vital in the custom. It is deep-rooted in our foolish hearts, he wrote, and it means something real, the outward expression of a genuine inward warmth of feeling. Just like that, Christmas 1903 came to a close. Fading alongside it was William Christmasville, whose byline never again graced the paper's pages. No matter, for the intrepid reporter had served his intended purpose, just as the editor had hoped. Together, in the darkest days of the year, they helped their city believe.
B.J. Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
WPR is pleased to support community connections. More information on the Hope for the Holidays Kwanzaa initiative is at urbantriage.org.
In sports, the Wisconsin men's basketball game that was scheduled for yesterday against George Mason was called off. The decision was made by UW medical officials after positive COVID-19 tests were found within the Wisconsin program. The women's game earlier in the day was also called off. Wisconsin Director of Athletics Chris McIntosh will not travel to Las Vegas for the Badger football team's bowl game against Arizona State, having tested positive for COVID-19 on Thursday.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The celebrity chef Jack Bishop has a motto.
My kitchen mantra is pretty simple. I serve whatever I cook and I smile. No one will actually complain, even if the food isn't perfect.
Go for it, in other words, and don't worry if things go wrong. Keep that thought in mind as we pass through the dramatic story that follows. Jack Bishop hosts the PBS television show America's Test Kitchen. He occasionally talks about cooking with us, and as the holidays arrive, he offered to show me a seemingly simple holiday recipe.
It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping.
Popcorn. What could be simpler than that? You just pop it. But Jack Bishop says you can dress up your popcorn to make it an elegant snack, so elegant that you could package it and give it as a gift.
So we're making spicy caramel popcorn. It's got just enough heat to compete with the saltiness and the sweet. And we're going to use smoked almonds. So you get another layer of flavor rather than just general nuts.
So here's the setup. I'm in my kitchen, and Jack Bishop is watching from his kitchen over Zoom and cooking along with me. We're mixing together popcorn, nuts, and spices, and the key is the caramel, the sauce that will harden and make it all stick together. I don't claim to be high class, so I started by using microwave popcorn, which Jack reluctantly allowed.
You can use bagged popcorn. You can use microwave popcorn. I pop my own popcorn because that's just the way I roll, but it really doesn't make much difference.
How do you pop the popcorn? Do you do it over an open fire? What's your method?
The trick is to take three kernels, put them in 3 tablespoons of oil, put the lid on, and then as soon as they pop, you put the remaining kernels in and just do it in a covered saucepan.
I'm trying to figure out why you do the 3 in advance. Is that to give the other popcorn confidence to pop? What are you doing there?
It's a signal that the oil's hot enough. It basically says when it pops, it's now ready to go. The tricky part of this recipe is we are making homemade caramel. And caramel is basically burnt sugar. But you don't want it really burnt. You want it somewhat burnt.
So you want to burn it without burning it. This is perfect for me.
So the trick to making caramel sauce is to have a heavy saucepan with a shiny surface. Caramel is all about the changing of the color of the sugar And if you do it in a dark pan, you have no idea what color the sugar actually is. So,
it needs to be shiny.
It needs to be shiny. It's really just about visibility.
It's all about visibility, true of so many things in society. Anyway, I put some water in the pan and then dumped a little mountain of sugar in there. You don't stir it, you just pile it in so the pile pokes above the water. And then we turned up the heat.
So are you getting any simmering?
Yes, I'm getting a little bit on the edges, yes.
And has your sugar dissolved or you're still in the process of dissolving the sugar?
It looks like it's dissolving, but there's still a small little island in the middle that is just now going underwater.
So this stage, we're going to wait until it's basically straw colored. That's the point where we're going to turn the heat way down to slow down the process even further so that we have a bigger window of getting the caramel just right.
Ooh, it's darkening. I looked away for a second and it's a darker brown now, I would say.
Yeah, I'm going to turn the heat down on mine to medium low.
I'm also just going to turn on the fan. I think our producer, Barry Gortimer, would be very amused if I set off the smoke alarm, but I'm going to try not to do that. I'm getting a very dark brown now.
Yeah, I'm a little worried that you got smoke.
A little worried? Well, here's a good moment to recall Jack's mantra.
I serve whatever I cook and I smile. No one will actually complain, even if the food isn't perfect.
But we were not going to serve this. As soon as we took it off the heat, the overdone caramel hardened like brown concrete.
That looks pretty dark to me. Does it smell pretty burnt?
I would say not massively burnt. I mean, I would say it smells burnish.
Steve, look.
Yes.
I just burnt my caramel because I wasn't paying attention.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Wow. And I'm not secretly happy that I wasn't the only one. Not at all.
It won't do to dream of caramel, to fan a hidden fire that can never burn true.
As Robert F. Kennedy once said, only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly. When you have to burn it. Without burning it, the margin between success and failure is just a few degrees on your thermometer. So we burned off the caramel concrete and tried all over again.
So tell me what's going on inside your pot.
We got some boiling, but you know what? Why don't I show it to you?
That looks good. As soon as you get close to dark amber, I want you to take the pan off the heat and then add the butter, which will immediately cool it down.
Okay, here it goes off the heat. Now do I dump in the salt and the cayenne?
Yep, the butter, the salt, and the cayenne, they can all go in. Swirl it so the butter is cooling the entire pot down.
Gotcha.
All right. Now remember, it's going to foam up quite a lot, but swirl it.
Yeah, it's starting to foam. Wow. It's starting to look like caramel is what I'm telling you.
Stir it with a spatula. Dump it on the popcorn. Dump in the nuts. And then just with a rubber spatula, toss it all together.
Oh, it smells amazing. You can smell the smoke of the almonds because the heat of the caramel brings that forth.
Oh, that looks so great, Steve.
Should I just try like one kernel? Is that okay to do?
No, you can break off just from the corner, break off a little piece.
Oh, yeah, you can taste the caramel. You can taste the nut. You do get a tiny bit of spiciness to it, but I would not say it's strongly spiced, but it's got a little aftertaste to it.
I think I put more cayenne in mine because I like mine spicier.
Uh-huh.
And I love the smokiness of the smoked almonds.
I think the smoked almonds are the key. I had thought that if I didn't find smoked almonds, I would just use regular almonds. And I feel lucky that I found the smoked almonds.
And now we just need to wait when it's cool, package it up, if it lasts that long.
I was going to say, might not.
And share it with somebody who you wanted to make something special for.
Jack Bishop hosts the PBS television show America's Test Kitchen. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. Wishing you a burn-free Christmas, I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. A festival of nine lessons and carols live from King's College in Cambridge, England is up next. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday weekend. This is WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years. Piasecki Funeral Home.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.